Okay, this evening, the question that was pulled out, and like last week's, it was typed, but it doesn't have a name on it. Last week's had a name on it. I told the person whose name was on last week's, I said, by the way, we pulled your question. I said, oh, well, I guess you'll have to come in here and give me a rehash. I said, no, it's online. You can go listen to it.
That question should be legit because it's not on the official yellow paper.
Well, there's green paper. It's lime green.
Right.
So, but this one says, with all of the advances in medicine, is it ever okay to take someone off life support? Is that not playing God? Okay.
Why is it okay to put them on to start with then?
That's right.
You play God in the way that you get right down to it.
Well, actually, I do have something about that down here and say if you know, using modern medicine instead of letting nature take its course, is that not in its own way playing God?
Yeah.
As someone said earlier just a little bit ago, we were chatting and they said, well, you know, really, with God was taking a whole lot of folks to be with him before the advent of antibiotics and surgical techniques and those kinds of things. Cindy, you said, can you say something?
Well, I was just going to say, you really kind of eliminate it if you have a living will and you take the choice away from everybody but yourself.
Well, living will, provided you make some notes on it, because living will actually in South Carolina, the living will, it's titled, Declaration for a Natural Death, but it only covers, at the outset, it only covers artificial nutrition and hydration and putting you on a ventilator and that kind of thing. Healthcare power of attorney is much more specific about things. Yes, it does designate someone to do that. But if you have, in the state of South Carolina, if you have a living will and a healthcare power of attorney, unless it's something that where you're, you know, there's no hope, you know, you're completely crushed or whatever. But if you have them both, even if your healthcare power of attorney says, do not put me on life support, the living will takes precedence, and for 72 hours you have to be put on life support. And then somebody has to say, okay, we're going to stop it or not. So a lot of folks don't know those things. But used to do ethics consults. And when I worked full-time for a year at the hospital, in all those non-busy areas that I had every day, ER, trauma ICU, neuro ICU, neurosurgery, and half of oncology, you know, nothing ever happens in those places. But you end up with a lot of ethics consults. And by the way, you can ask for ethics consults if you have a disagreement or you have concerns, you know, a disagreement with the doctor or nurses over what's happening with a patient or not. Sometimes doctors and nurses will call ethics consults, although I don't think they're quite as prevalent as they were a number of years ago. But you call an ethics consult and get the family and the docs and the nurses that give the primary care, as well as social workers who are dealing with the patient and others in there. If there's a question, for example, the patient's family says, look, we don't want to continue this care. It's not working and they're suffering. And the docs say, oh, but we think we need to keep doing it. We need to run this test and that test. And if you're butting heads, you can call for an ethics consult. Or the docs say, we've done these tests and we think you just need to go ahead and pull the plug and let them go. And the family says, no, we're not going to do that. Or the nurses say, you know, well, the docs aren't really paying attention to this and this and this. Then an ethics consult can be called. Also include someone from pastoral care. Yes. Well, that depends on what all is going on.
Yeah,
but
and with her dementia and her age.
Yeah. Right. Well, and the average person doesn't know, so I'm telling you, the average person doesn't know. You can actually ask for an ethics consult. Yes, Gary. Oh, no, it's hospital staff. And there'll be someone from pastoral care. There will be social workers. Sometimes there's a VP that's involved. Sometimes, depending on what the case is, I have sat in on ethics consults before where there were attorneys present, as well as all the family and all the primary care nurses and physicians and those kinds of things. When there's, especially if there's widespread disagreement about what should be done. What happens with an ethics consult is you get all these people in the room and then you talk out and the docs lay out their case and the nurses lay out their case and the family lays out its case and asks questions and the social worker lays out theirs, and then through all the discussion they hope to come to a consensus. You know, the docs can't vote and say, well, we got you outnumbered 8-6, so our decision stands. Ultimately, whoever the patient has designated as their primary person, or if it's in the case of a family member, certain family members get priority. They can ultimately say, no, you do this or you don't do that, even after the doc explained it. But the whole point is to get in here. Let's get on the same page. Let's understand all of this. And then we try to come to a consensus. Right, right. Right. Yeah, well, in the state of South Carolina, he would have had, in the state of South Carolina, and I have stood in years past, I have stood and actually ended up on a couple of occasions, we had to call security. Stood in an ICU, the husband or the wife, and I mean, the divorce was just a matter of days away in one case, and this spouse came in with their significant other into the room to tell them to pull the plug, and the family's over there saying no, and it got past words, it got to shoving and all that kind of stuff. Because in the state of South Carolina, until that divorce is final, that spouse has the right. Nobody else, not mom, not dad, nobody else has the right. Well, but that's the way the legislation's set up. Right. Well, and that can happen. And where I was going initially with the ethics consult is Stuart Sprague, who was a former colleague of mine at Anderson. Stuart's PhD was in the area of ethics, and in particular medical ethics. And Stuart, a number of years ago, left Anderson after some administrative changes there. Hard right turn. Stuart left there, and he went into private consulting. And he actually teaches courses to docs all around the upstate on medical ethics and raising questions and all those kinds of things. But Stuart was on retainer with the hospital, and he would come in when there was an ethics consult. And I will remember, I hope, for a long time how he would start those. We'd get everybody in the room, there would be introductions, and then he would say, you know, we're here today to talk about this situation, this case. He said, and among the things we need to look at are two things in particular. What can we do with medicine and the advances in medicine? We can do a lot to keep this person going. But the real question that comes to mind is, but what should we do? And that, he said, that's the purpose of this ethics consult, is to decide what should we do, not just what can we do. And so when it comes to these decisions about affectionately known as pulling the plug, which really that's what's happening. You know, it's not like, trying to add a little levity here, the minister who went in to see his parishioner back in the days before they had the oxygen tents. I've told you, some of y'all, this before. He went in to see the minister, went in to see his parishioner, and he's standing there by the bed, and the guy sleeping, suddenly wakes up, and he starts, and he said, what? I can't hear you, and they won't let me get under the oxygen tent. He said, here's a pen and a piece of paper. Write down what you're trying to say. And the guy starts writing furiously, and all of a sudden, flat lines, that's it. So the minister takes a note, and he sticks it in his pocket, and he starts out, starts down the hallway, and here comes a man's wife. And he stops. I'm so sorry. I hate to be the one to tell you this, but your husband just died. I was in the room with him, though, and he just died. And he wrote down, in fact, I've got his last words here. And he pulls a note out and says, preacher, you're standing on the air hose. So we're not talking about that kind of thing where you stand on the air hose. Well, and that's part of it. There's a story. Anybody ever see Rollerball? The movie Rollerball? James Caan was in the first one. I didn't like the remake. Skating in the future and that kind of thing. Well, there's a section in there in Rollerball where one of the characters is killed in an accident. His head's crushed, but his brain is dead, but the rest of his organs are functioning. Okay? And this friend, who's his best friend, is so devastated, he decides he's got the money, and he wants to keep the body alive. And so he does. He keeps the body alive, though the brain is dead and the man's head's crushed, he keeps the body alive, and he'll go and sit down and talk to it and that kind of thing. So that's really where this question comes. What can we do? They had the ability to keep the body alive, even though the brain was dead, and what should we do? Should we let them go on, or should we make the expenditure of time, effort, money, all that kind of stuff to do it? A lot of times when it comes down to you're told someone is brain dead, that can kind of make the decision a little bit easier. But how do you define brain death? Okay. EEG. No brainwave activity. There are other tests. Sometimes you don't want to be in the room when they do them, but there are other tests. There's no unassisted breathing. Pupils do not react at all to light. And there's no reaction at all to pain stimulus, which is anything from digging into the nail beds to pouring cold water in the ear while they watch the pupils, those kinds of things. And so those are signs that the brain is dead. The brain is not going to recover. It doesn't mean other organs are dead yet. They can function for a while, and as long as you keep the oxygen coming and the other things coming, they can function for a while. Jim, the heart has its own pacemaker. And actually, the heart, as long as you supply oxygen, the heart will keep beating, even if the brain's gone. In fact, medical experiments have been done in the past, and you could actually take a beating heart out of someone, put it in a saline solution, keep oxygen flowing to it, and it'll keep beating. Yeah. They dumped you in a saline solution?
That was my brain.
Yes, Karen. That's that's the question, okay? That's part of the question. The other organs may begin to deteriorate after a short period of time. The heart can keep going. But once the brain dies, once the brain cells cease to function, you're not going to bring them back. You're not going to bring them back. And that's where people get to talking about the soul or the spirit. That's where people get to talking, is the soul still there or is it gone on? Is the spirit still there or is it gone on? Okay? So there are a lot of different things to think about in all of this. And really, if you think about it, if the brain is dead and it's not going to recover and you stop the machine, you're not killing the person because they're already dead. Those other organs might be going for a while, but the person, that which keeps them alive on its own, the brain, is dead, so technically the person is dead at that point in time.
Aren't there stories that I've heard people been in a coma for even years?
And come back out of it, but they weren't brain dead.
That's my question. How, when someone is not flatlined but just lying like that, how do they determine if they're brain dead or not? You've got
physical tests, EEGs. They've got tests and then machines. The electroencephalograph. That's your brainwaves.
There wouldn't be a decision, would there, if it's a possibility?
In a coma?
Yeah.
Yes and no. It depends. It depends. If you have a healthcare power of attorney and say, I don't want my life sustained, if death would possibly occur in a short period of time and this machine's the only thing keeping me, turn it off. And if your person does what you say, And that's one of the things with the healthcare power of attorney in South Carolina. They have every right, once you can't make a decision, whoever your designee is has every right to make the decision just as if you were alive. And they can say, okay, yeah, I'm going to do this. Or no, I don't care what it costs. I want to keep them alive. And I see that. Right. Right. And so, you know, but they run tests, physical tests. They run EEGs. There are other means to tell whether that brain is functioning or not.
So everything is kind of nil, but your brain functioning, in most instances, you probably want to say keep the person alive.
If the brain's functioning, yes, and well, a lot of people would, but some people say, okay, well, the machine is overriding all this stuff. They're not really breathing on their own. Let's turn it off and see what happens. And if they keep breathing, then okay. I've stood in rooms where they stop breathing and some family member pitched a fit and they turned the machine back on. But then later on, you know, but we, even with machines, we can only keep people alive so long anyway. Eventually, when the brainstem quits. I tell folks all the time, you know, if there's something and if there's a question and there's nothing else going on, especially in an ICU situation, ask for a brain perfusion scan. A brain perfusion scan, they may call it something else now, but that's what we used to call it. Brain perfusion scan, they check to see where the blood flow is going. And if the blood flow is not going into the areas where the higher sensibilities are, but it's staying around the bloodstem or the brainstem, then all the higher functions are gone. The only thing going is that rudimentary brainstem that, and that's where people, when they turn off a machine and they get to the agonal breathing, and people say, oh, they're suffering. No, all that other stuff's gone. It's just that brainstem until it quits. And that can be difficult to watch. But some think that the machines are the equivalent of playing God, as we said a while ago. The medications are the equivalent of playing God because it disrupts the natural order of things. Right? I mean, we can keep people alive a long, long time. Miss Sally wouldn't be enjoying her 99th birthday were it not for medicines and surgeries and those kinds of things. Right? A lot of us wouldn't. Yeah. A lot of us wouldn't. Some of the questions that get asked are, okay, with the rising cost of health care and everything else, is it good stewardship to keep somebody alive that may be semi-comatose or maybe comatose or might be brain dead? You know, I have known people who said, I don't care how much it costs, I want my body kept alive until it quits on its own. So, you know, those kinds of questions come up. Well, and, you know, so really, you know, when brain death occurs, there's really no value judgment as to whether to unplug or not because the person's already dead. Okay? But then that gets into but wait a minute, they're a human being. It's not like an animal. It's not like a dog that you put down. Or, you know, I remember that movie, and I never did figure out exactly what the title had to do with this dance contest, but the name of the movie was They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Right? Now, you've been dead and come back. Now, we're not talking about that. We're talking if you were dead and came back, and then you died again, and they couldn't get you back. And it's just the machines. Cryogenic stuff. Yeah. Who is it? Who was the guy several years ago that he's had his body frozen? Yeah. So, and to be thawed out again when they discover a cure for what was wrong with him. But you know that's good science fiction kind of stuff. But we can do things similarly, can we not? We freeze embryos for indefinite periods of time. So what makes us human? Why does it get to this? You know, social scientists would say it's conscious interaction with other people, significant exchanges. That makes us human, separates us. Other people say it's our ability to think, to reason, to ask questions. That separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom. But to think and ask questions and make decisions also involves social interaction, does it not? You know, an awareness of self.
Uh-huh.
my brain to override emotions.
That you have a higher
yeah. Some people do, but yeah. Right. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But that's that ability to. No. Animals act out of instinct. The ability to, it's a matter of using the, it's whether you use the ability or not. That's right, Sybil. It's whether you use that or not. You know, people oftentimes don't these days, especially. But that is personality, personhood or personality, which includes conscience and other elements of personality, are distinctively different. Although, I'm going to tell you, that cat of ours has a personality and a half and really is more like a dog. But you can look up Russian Blue, even though he's not purebred, you can look up Russian Blue, and you might as well have Church's picture there because everything, boom, 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 he does. And he wants to be around people. And he wants to sleep under the covers in the winter. And he wants to meet you at the door. And he expects to be in the same room with you most of the time. And he talks to you all the time, although I can't understand it, but that's okay. He probably doesn't understand a whole lot of what I say back to him, except when I raise my voice in it. But, you know, personality, personhood, the ability to communicate in those ways, the intellect with which to think and reason and know right from wrong.
Some people
say
language.
Language. Although they say the dwarfuses. The porpoises or dolphins have their own little language. But yes, those kinds of things are personal. And they involve interaction, right? Good or bad, they involve interaction. But some folks say that doesn't take into account the soul. Okay? The soul. In biblical accounts, the soul refers to the total human personality. In Greek, the word is psuche, from which we get psyche, but the psyche, the mind, the ability to think, to reason, those kinds of things. One writer says, and I quote, "A soul is all that an individual becomes in the course of a lifetime, and it is the sum total of a person's humanity created over the years which survives the grave. With brain death, the personhood or soul is no longer alive in the body, and it is on this basis that the plug can be pulled and the bodily remains allowed to expire because the soul, the psuche, is no longer in the body." And we find in places like the New Testament, to be absent from the body, present with the Lord. And it's appointed unto man once to die and then the judgment. Well, the judgment was on the soul or the spirit. But that's in the case of brain death. That's probably a little bit. And by the way, part of the whole concept of Sheol within Hebrew thought, the underworld, etc., where everybody went, their soul went good or bad. It was like being trapped. As I used to say to folks, and I can use it in this room, and most people will understand it because you've at least seen one Sherlock Holmes movie with Basil Rathbone. But it was like being trapped on the Scottish moors at night in the fog in a Sherlock Holmes movie, except you don't have the Hound of the Baskervilles. You know? It's just kind of a shadowy existence. It wasn't good or bad. It was that way because it was under the earth and removed from where God was. That was Sheol. But Sheol was also a means of trying to deal with and get people to understand that, yes, there is something that lives on, that is that soul, that spark that God gives us, that spirit. But when it went to that place, it didn't come back. Most major world religions, especially Eastern religions, Far Eastern religions, but most major world religions believe that at least once a year, all the spirits come back. And they can do good or bad. And they will leave out food for the spirits. They'll do other things for the spirits. So hopefully, they'll go back where they're supposed to be afterwards. But they can do harm or they can do good to you. I mean, most, especially Far Eastern religions, they have specific days. Some of them are around New Year. Some of them are the winter solstice. Some of them are in the summer. But there will be a day where all the souls come back from where they are. And there was that question and that fear among a lot of ancient peoples. Sheol, once you went, you didn't get out because you did. That's where your soul goes. And it was actually a means within the Old Testament of trying to help people overcome the fear that those spirits might come back. Because a lot of their neighbors and their neighboring religions believed that you had to sacrifice here and sacrifice there because that spirit might come back and do you harm. A lot of those world religions, especially Far Eastern religions, believe that not only can the spirits do you harm, but you, by your actions, can actually harm the spirits of your ancestors in the underworld or in the afterlife and cause them pain, in which instance they'll probably react against you to cause you pain. But if you make sacrifices and all this kind of stuff and do things good for them, then when good fortune befalls you, oftentimes those who practice Taoism and Confucianism and even Buddhism and others will say, ah, well, then we have venerated the ancestors properly and they have helped us out. But that wasn't the biblical understanding of that. So brain death is one thing. Brain death, brain's dead, can't come back, pull the plug. But what of the situation in which a person who is conscious or who is comatose, but there's still that activity, is being kept alive by artificial means? Therein comes the big question. And what if that person is conscious enough and they have a debilitating disease that's going to result in death and they want to take the machines off? Is it okay?
What about that same person who is not on machines, has a debilitating disease? There are, what, 5 states now that allow a person to...
Euthanasia, and that's not young people over in China.
No,
that's, yeah, and I'm not, yeah, now I'm not talking, well, I'm, and that people say that's mercy killing. I'm not talking about mercy killing, because what is the difference in mercy killing and stopping what's being done? Oh, yes. Mercy killing, euthanasia, is actively doing something to end the life. Yes.
I don't see nothing wrong with that in some cases, though.
Some people's genes need to be taken out of the gene pool. But, but yeah, I want to.
Maybe somebody with Alzheimer's is real far along, you know.
And I have often thought, and I don't know that I really would, but I've often thought, and I've even said to Mary in the past when we've known someone that had ALS or had a friend who said, just before I can no longer get behind the wheel of a car, just turn me loose on the interstate. Bridge abutment, here we come. But, you know.
Hit somebody first.
Right, right. But the decision.
I'll go along with that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about, not mercy killing, but simply stopping the things that are interrupting the process. Right.
Their brain is
still. It is a dilemma with Hawking. But Stephen Hawking's not being kept alive by those machines.
But at that point, at some point, he may get to that.
But if he does, then that's the question. Do you put him there, and if he gets to a point, do you simply stop what would cause the natural process? Mercy killing itself is an unnatural death, whereas stopping the medications or stopping the ventilator allows a natural death to take place. Yes. Well, hospice does more than just help you die. I have known people who, you know, hospice comes in when you've basically been told you got 6 months or less, and I've known a few cases where after 6 months a person had recouped well enough to where hospice says, okay, Next time you need us, call us. And but generally, when I've also known more people that didn't make it a month after hospice was called in. Karen? Well, they do, but they're not being kept alive by machines. To do something to that child is, you might even want to call it a mercy killing, but that's to actively kill. As opposed to removing someone who is, we've already played God and put them on the machines. And they've gotten to a point now to where remove the machines. And that's, to stop the machines or certain medications means just to stop fighting what God would allow to happen. And not interfere. Yeah. Doctors take an oath, right? And they take an oath to prolong life. And the docs want to prolong life. When we faced the situation with my mother. I know some of y'all have too. We faced a situation with my mother in 2014 in December when she was in the hospital and the docs were saying her kidneys were starting to shut down. But she was there, and we finally convinced her. I wasn't there yet, but my sister and one of my brothers finally convinced her to sign a DNR. Yeah. Yes. But I was standing there on Sunday before she died on Tuesday. I'm standing there on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, and she codes. And here comes the nurse with the crash cart, because what are you trained to do? You're trained to keep people alive. I see it all the time in the hospital. There'll be 15 people in the room, and they're taking turns doing compressions and everything else. And, I mean, the drugs that get popped in there. Epi and everything else. Yes, Bill. And had they seen the DNR on his chart, they wouldn't have done that. It was on the chart, but nobody picked up the chart. But here comes a nurse pushing as fast as she could go to the room, and I'm standing, because I was outside so my mother could use the side commode, and there was a nurse in there with her. After that, she went from the commode here to the chair here and fell out. And they pulled a little chain there for code. Here comes the nurse running, and I'm looking. I said, and I could see my mother slumped over, tongue lolling out of her mouth. The thing was flatlining, and I said, she's a DNR. And the nurses, I said, she's a DNR. And she stopped, and she looked up, but she still ran in. I know the name of the med, but I can't. They popped that medicine in her veins and got her back. And out there, had done that two or three times the day before. And they did that in the middle of Sunday night while my sister was staying there. She fell out, and they came running in. My sister said, she's a DNR. They popped her with a medication. Starts with an A. It wasn't ephedrine. It was something with an A. Nah. But anyway, I found out in North Carolina, and I've talked to people in South Carolina, it makes a couple of docs, and they said, well, that's the case here too. If you don't specifically say don't put in meds, DNR only means we're not going to shock you and we're not going to do chest compressions. They're still going to pop in the heart medications. And they do that. And they'll do that and get people back. And you stand there and I say, well, we're putting in as much medication as we can. We can't give any more medication to keep the heart going. And the heart rate's still fluctuating. And the blood pressure's still fluctuating. What do you want us to do? So we were sitting there dealing with that. They kept doing the medicines. Every time she went into arrhythmia and stopped. Kidneys were starting to shut down. She started losing the functioning of her brain. They would ask her questions. Well, I was standing in the room. We were all there, and the docs came around, and the nurse started asking her questions. Said, okay, Ms. Hearn, what's 2 plus 2? And she sat there and said, Ms. Hearn, what's 2 plus 2? And she started crying. And then she said, I don't know. And then she said, well, what's your address? And she looked down like this and started crying more. I said, Ms. Hearn, what's your address? She looked at my sister and said, why are they asking me such hard questions? And asked her two or three others like that, simple things that she couldn't answer.
Are there a way around, since DNR does not, are there a way around?
You can tell them. We told them at that point, we got the docs out, And we went in a conference room and said, look. And it was that that convinced my youngest brother we should stop the medications. And we said, look, we don't want her suffering, because every time you go out and they bring you back, your body suffers.
Yes, sir.
And so, right?
Yes, sir.
And so we said, no more. And in fact, she kept picking at the monitor, take those off too. No more. Oh, but we won't know when her heart stops and when to go. She's already a DNR. No more medications. Take it off. That was on Monday. Yeah. That was on Monday, and she died on Tuesday. That was not an easy decision to make. But, yeah. So, you know, where do you start? Did we make the right decision? I think we did. Right. Well, and they weren't. They wanted to keep doing it.
Well, I understand, but my younger sister had bacterial meningitis. I mean, she went to bed fine.
Right.
Woke up the next day sick at 4:00 the next day. My other sister found her, and they said had she not gotten her to the hospital when she did, she would have died before she got there. And within less than a week's time, they're trying to get her son to take her off life support. This is in 2008. I mean, she's living a good life now.
Right.
It's a hard, and
I tell folks all the time, that, and especially spouses, and they'll be sitting there and they've got a healthcare power of attorney and say, but I just can't bring myself to tell them to go ahead and kill her. And I say,
sometimes the age, the condition,
yeah, that's not.
Like he was saying, Alzheimer's, yeah. We've been through that with two of my brothers. You know, one brother with congestive heart failure.
Right.
And, you know, just the whole history of stuff,
I think. And I will tell them, say, well, you're not killing them. That's their wishes. But it does make it difficult like that. And especially when you know of a case where they would have been dead, they could have been dead, and now they're living. Mm-hmm. Hazel.
When my sister Ruth was at Greenwood Memorial,
right,
from Lawrence Hospital, that's right there, and she was in kidney failure, and she'd been there over a week, and the Dr. Smith that was seeing for her said that they were going to dialyze her on Wednesday. And so I went to his station.
Right.
That's what it's called. And I said, Dr. Smith, after you dialyze her, what then? And you know what he said? There was nothing else to do.
Right.
And I said, she does not want that. And he said, you're sure about that? I said, I'm positive. We've talked about it.
Right.
And she had a written thing at that Lawrence Hospital, but it didn't get to the Greenville Hospital.
Well, and I will.
He accepted my word for it.
Right.
And did not dialyze it.
Well, and those are tough decisions, but I will tell you that if you take your healthcare power of attorney in and you put it in your record for this hospital visit, and when you leave and you come back later for another hospital visit, guess what's not in your record? You have to bring it every time because they don't keep it. Well, but they don't know that you haven't changed your mind between now and then. And the computers, trust me, they've changed the computer system. The amount of time I have to spend charting when I work, the amount of time I have to spend charting is 2 to 3 times what it used to be, just to handwrite stuff. And then we still have to print out reports. So much for this. We're going to go to an all-electronic and save paper. Yeah, but, you know, so these are not, but they're not easy decisions to make. Yeah, because what are we told? We're told that you're not supposed to, do not kill. But if the, yeah, if the person is already there, or, okay, well, there was a, I can't remember Brenda's last name right now. She actually came to church here a couple of times several years ago. But, not talking about Brenda and Floyd. But she was the trauma ICU head nurse. And her sister had had a massive head bleed. Her sister never got married. She was her sister's healthcare power of attorney. And so she finally, at one point, she looked at the brain perfusion scans and everything else. She went in, had the doctors do the tests, and said, okay, take her off. She would not want this. I know she doesn't want this. I'm hurt. And she said, she won't make it. But, you know, a short time. They would say, well, we're going to move her into another room, let you have time with her. Brenda never left that room for the next 35 plus hours. The one time she left the room at 36 hours, her sister died. But she was sure it's only going to be a matter of a couple of hours. And 36 hours later is when she finally... Right. That's the thing. If you get to that point and you make that decision, as gut-wrenching and as heart-wrenching as it may be, then it's a matter of, okay, if they continue to live and continue to breathe and all of that, then they were meant to. If not, you haven't killed them. You've let the natural course go on. But those are very difficult decisions. Is it ever okay to take them off? That was the question. With all the advances of medicine, ever okay to take someone off life support? Is that not playing God? Well, I think we've talked about playing God sometimes to put them on the life support. Right. It does that. And yet, God, I think, gives us the abilities and gives... Dr. Young, and I know we've run over a couple of minutes, go figure. Dr. Young, who did David's surgery, and I think I told some of y'all this, Dave was very impressed with him. Dr. Young came in, and after he talked ahead of time, then he said, can we pray? And he led in prayer. And he wanted everybody to hold hands, and he led in prayer. When we were in the waiting room, and he finished the surgery, and he came out to report to us, he reported, and then, can we have prayer? And Dr. Young prayed. But I will tell you this. I've told a few folks, I don't know if I've told everyone, but I will tell you this. Dr. Young thanked God for giving him the ability to learn the things that he had and to develop the skills that he had. And in the before time, he said, so, Lord, I ask if you would please heighten those skills and allow me to use them to my best ability. And when he came out and said, David's fine, go home in a little while, etc. And when he prayed, he thanked God for being with him and allowing him to use those skills with which he had been blessed to help David. Yes. Yeah. So he'll pray with you. And if he doesn't, say, can we pray? No, he'll ask if he can pray with you. So I think the answer is yes, there are times that it's appropriate. And it's not mercy killing, which involves actively doing something to take the life. But it is allowing God to use natural course. But it takes different people different times to get there, if ever. Prolonging life as long as possible is not wrong or sinful. I personally, and that and a dollar get you to drink the drink machine, less or more expensive or less expensive, would say that there are times where it's appropriate to stop the things that are going on and let God take the person. And it's not sinful. Well, only if you read the infancy gospel of Thomas. But.
So. How do you feel about Christian Science? Let God do it, and let them believe in true medicine.
Well, and that's another thing with Christian Scientists, with Jehovah's Witnesses, and no blood transfusions with Jehovah's Witnesses, because you're not to mingle the blood, right? Right.
Do you believe what the Bible says, that the hairs of our head are numbered and cover our days?
I think God knows when that will be. I'm not I'm not so sure that God predetermines when it's going to be, but I think there's a difference in foreknowledge and predestination or predeterminism.
Because I've heard people say that. You know,
right.
Say,
well, the Bible says that. Yeah. And they say, yes, that's, and so you're not going to slow it down any more than it's going to be.
Right.
Right. There will be people that will say that's a predetermined way that it was going to happen anyway. That God knew, not only knew that, but God predetermined that all of this was going to happen before you finally went. So it depends on the book of prayer. Has a little short statement that I thought was interesting. It's a prayer for those who are dying, or anyone, whether they're dying or not, but especially for those who are dying. And it goes, from dying suddenly and unprepared, good Lord, deliver us. Which is an emphasis on always making sure that we're prepared when it does happen. That is, we're prepared with God and with others when it does happen. So, you know, a lot of folks don't want to talk about these kinds of things. Ed thought I'd scared every one of y'all off. You scared everybody off this morning. I don't recall it.
I looked up asunder and gave a couple of instances. But
he was hewn asunder or torn asunder. Anything else? I hope it's been helpful, at least to get out there and to think about it. Because we never know when we're going to be in a situation where we have to make a decision. Do I let the person go or not? And I think probably the more we know about the processes, and the more we connect with God and with others, and develop a deep-seated faith and conviction, the more prepared we will be when the time comes. Doesn't mean we will ever be fully prepared, but the more prepared we will be when the time comes. And I hope that time doesn't come for you. I think we'd all like, when the time finally comes, I think every one of us would prefer if we could just go to sleep one night and that's it. Fortunately, we live in a world that's fallen and in which those things don't always happen that way, and sometimes we pay for other people's choices. So, if there's nothing else, for the good of the order this evening, God bless you and go in peace. Thank you. Amen.